Europa Voice numéro 140, je suis comme d'habitude avec Nathanaël Bloch. Nathanaël, bonjour.
Bonjour Christophe.
On va parler anglais aujourd'hui parce que nous avons un guest avec nous, un invité. So we are going to speak in English. I'm letting you, I want you to introduce yourself, it's probably better. You are from RMIT, but you're the head of European studies. Explain to us exactly your role.
Good afternoon. My name's Bruce Wilson. I'm the director of the European Union Centre of Excellence at RMIT University. We've had an EU centre at RMIT for some 15 years, and we have a particular role in helping Australians to understand more about the European Union, but also trying to build partnerships between businesses, academics, community organisations and their counterparts in the European Union.
It's a job and a half.
It's a fantastic job. Yeah.
Nathanael, if you want to start the questions.
Me, Bruce, I will begin with something very topical that happened yesterday in Europe. With the shooting in Slovakia with FICO. Do we know more about it? But above all, it's kind of a reminder that some wars in Europe in the last century began also with some assassination tentative.
In that part of the world.
In that part of the world, exactly. Mm-hmm. So what does it say about the level of violence in politics in Europe and the extremism?
Unfortunately, I do not know any more than is what is available in the public news. So that's a quick answer to the first part of your question. But on the second, I think over the last decade, we have seen a range of acts described from time to time, particularly violent. I'm not persuaded that this is a harbinger to anything more than another one of those moments when there's a real jolt that, yes, something like this can happen in Europe. I'd be surprised if this led to something more far-reaching than being regarded as a terrorist act and dealt with accordingly.
But it could show that Europe has progressed in the last 100 and so years, because something like this 100 years ago created a war. Today, it's not going to create a third world war. We can safely say this. But there is a gap here. You can see there is progress between how Europe was 100 years ago, all the work that's been done for this, and then now.
Absolutely. And of course, that is the whole point of the European Union. And we teach about the European Union at RMIT, and we start with the very simple proposition that the Second World War was the second war within 30 years in Europe that caused enormous devastation. There was a very concrete choice made by European leaders that they never wanted that to happen again. And there was a very clear process to achieve that. They began by putting the French and German resources for making war under the control of the same entity, the European Coal and Steel Corporation. It was set up so that neither Germany nor France could make weapons of war to use against each other. And that principle of promoting peace has been at the heart of the European project for the last 70 years.
But what I think we also relate to this is we have the European elections coming up very shortly. It's a bit of a crucial time. European elections have been disregarded in the past as, at least from the French side, as a sideways election. But there's an extra focus this year on them because the politics is going a bit on the right side of the politics at the minute all across Europe, something we've debated a lot here. Is it something you feel in your studies?
It's very interesting. And yes, certainly all the indications are that the vote for parties on the right will increase. Will it increase to the point where it has a significant impact in European politics? I don't think so. We expect that the control of the European Parliament and hence of the European project will firmly remain in the hands of the centre-right and the centre-left, as it has throughout the whole life of the EU until now. As they do at the present time, they will probably rely on a third source of support. It is at the present time the Liberals. It will probably still be the Liberals, but in a reduced level than they have at the present time. So, I mean, the politics of Europe over 75 years is not constant. At different times, there have been clearly moments of crisis. In fact, one of the things that's often said about the development of the European Union is that the biggest steps are taken in times of crisis, that if things are kind of just moving along reasonably well, people tend to let things lie. But the momentum for the expansion, the enlargement. Of course, we all need to remember that until 2004, the European Union was really the Western European Union. You mentioned Slovakia earlier. It's only been a member of the EU for less than 20 years. And that is the case for a range of other East European nations. Even 2013, the most recent member to join Croatia. Mm-hmm. So there is an ebb and flow.
And if we look at who's knocking at the door as well, they're all from that part of the world as well.
Absolutely. The Balkans... it's very interesting when you mention the Balkans, because Serbia is probably the first on that list. Their recent engagement with the Chinese President Xi Jinping probably doesn't help their cause, but we'll see.
You mentioned Central Europe and some of the Western Balkan countries. A couple of days ago also, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of new countries entering the EU in 2004. We always quote Poland as a good example of economic development through and thanks to EU, since they entered EU. What can we say for the countries who entered EU in 2004? Is it a success, according to you?
That's a really good question. And I think the first thing to be clear about is the criteria. What criterion would you use to make that judgment? If you're talking about the economy, I think it has to be unequivocally said that their membership of the EU is a success, because in every one of those new members, there has been an enhancement of their economic standing, both in terms of their relative GDP, but also the actual character of the economy in those countries. Is it a project that's completed? Of course not. They're on a journey. But I think it's very straightforward to say that they have made more progress through being members of the EU than they would have had they not been. On other questions to do with democracy, for example, this is a more complex question. And I'd point to the fact that two other members of the European Union, Spain and Portugal, were under fascist control until 50 years ago. They both joined the European Community, then the European Union, within 20 years of the end of...
1986.
The end of fascism. Even now, would we say that Spain and Portugal have developed their democratic processes to the point where they are fully fledged members of the EU? Do we expect former communist countries to be fully fledged democracies within 20 years? You're asking a lot. You've got leadership in all of those countries right now who learnt their political ways, whose early experience of government was under authoritarian rule. It's a big ask for them to be now expected to operate in the same way that, for example, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom would.
It's very interesting, that point. Actually, talking about the United Kingdom, very quickly, Brexit, of course, something that we've been talking so much here. It's been our Madeleine de Proust, as we say, in something that comes back every time as your best cake that you can serve. How did you live through that whole Brexit? It was exciting from our point of view. Was it as exciting for you?
It meant very long days, Christoph, because I was often following British developments late into the night.
I was watching the Parliament debate and we were talking about the order. It was fantastic.
Exactly, John Bercow, the Speaker, who became a celebrity. whoever heard of the Speaker of a Parliament being a celebrity? But his role was so crucial through that time, and he had to make decisions that were so influential.
Obviously, when we talk about Brexit, we think about other types of exits. According to you, do we have to be scared of a Frexit with Le Pen, of a Dexit with the German AfD, of an Italxit, or whatever we can call it? Do you think it's something that is likely to happen in other EU countries?
My position on this is very simple. No. It's not to say, of course, that it's still not on the agenda. But if you take France, they no longer talk about France exiting the EU at all. reforming the EU, changing some of the parameters? Absolutely. To the best of my knowledge, the only political party that is currently even contemplating an exit is actually the Swedish far-right party. They are still advocates of Sweden exiting the EU. That's never going to happen. As far as the AfD go in Germany, they're actually losing votes at the present time. And interestingly, they seem to be losing those votes to a far left, perhaps far left is too strong, but a clearly left party, which says something, I think, about the disaffection of a certain segment of the German voting population. But it's not necessarily for left or right. It's for something different than they have now that the current constellation of mainstream parties cannot deliver.
It's something we see in Europe from La France Insoumise to all the extreme right parties. There's a very big link between who votes for these people. It's interesting what you mentioned as well, because even in the Netherlands, where they have elected and someone that was representing the far right, they are really struggling to form government over there. They are really struggling. So yes, they've been put in front of the voting system and they won in the election, but when it comes to actually forming a government, they're still not completely there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw a similar kind, perhaps different framing, but not dissimilar in some ways in Belgium for, I think it took them almost 2 years to form a government.
And it's actually probably their best years when you talk to the Belgian people. Yeah. It's the best year they had was without government. Let's just refocus on what all this means for Australia. So we have elections coming up here in June. There's something that we've been talking a lot as well is the exchange between the fair trade exchange between Australia and Europe. Where are we at? Because when Macron came here, it was I actually asked him a question, Macron, about it, and he answered that was coming up. But at the time, you know, we had two or three different prime ministers since then here. Where are we at?
And a couple of submarines.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of submarines in and out. Where are we at?
You raised several things in that question. The first is that currently the negotiations, to give you a technical answer, the negotiations are suspended. They were suspended at the decision of the Australian Trade Minister in October 2023. And the current position of the Australian government is that they expect trade negotiations to resume, but quite probably not until after the Australian elections in 2025. From an EU perspective, they were very, very disappointed at the way in which Australia ended the negotiations last year. They felt that it was based on a misunderstanding, would be the polite way to put it, and the negotiators themselves felt that they were very close to an agreement. The response of the Australian government suggests that there are some domestic issues that are still at play that are in the way. From the point of the EU, their negotiators would return to the table tomorrow in some confidence that a deal is very close. So the ball is really in the hands at the present time of the Australian government. And possibly after the June elections, something could happen before the end of the year. If it doesn't happen by October, then there will be a change in the European Commission, and we will have to see how that lands early in 2025.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's remain positive on this. It can happen. It will happen.
The thing that's disappointing to me, I've been actively linked with the negotiations since they began. There is so much in this trade deal that would be of benefit to both Europe and to Australia. And we now have a lot of research evidence that demonstrates that those companies that do engage in trade provide better quality jobs, they pay more, and they generate more employment. And we would like to see that happen.
And just to extrapolate on this, the submarine fiasco, let's put this name, fiasco, the submarine fiasco, how much did that dent that discussion?
Very seriously. And if there had not been a change of government in May 2022, the relationships between Australia and the EU would still be very difficult, I believe. After that election, Prime Minister Albanese met President Macron quickly. They formed a good working relationship. Albanese has met also with the European Commission President and other senior EU leaders. They also have active working relationships. So I think we would be in a very different circumstance if that hadn't happened. But the immediate response of the EU, as well as France, to the decisions around the submarines was, of course, one of shock and then of serious disappointment.
At the time we record this podcast, Bruce, some serious incidents happened in the Indo-Pacific and in New Caledonia. So there's a lot of instability in the region. There's also the willingness of China to be more and more involved, let's call it like that, in the Pacific region. Do you think that what happens in the Pacific will automatically also make Australia and France and Australia and the EU work more together to ensure the stability of the region?
This is very clearly part of the intent of the European Union and of France specifically. France was the first European Union member state to have an Indo-Pacific strategy. And in 2021, ironically, the same day as Prime Minister Morrison announced AUKUS, the EU announced its Indo-Pacific strategy. Both documents are very clearly about asserting the interest of France and the EU in the Pacific. The Pacific, of course, is home to to France's largest exclusive economic zone. There's more of France in the Pacific than there is in Europe, something not many people know. And they are also Australia's nearest neighbour. Again, something that not many people know. Mm. So the potential of this relationship to be much more significant than it is now is very real.
Yeah, we're going to have to close this interview very soon. But just to conclude, how much of the interest from the Australian public has risen in the general opinion for Europe, for European Union, for Europe? It seems to me that for a long time in here it was Britain first. It was always Britain is the gateway to Europe. You know, the people here were not going to Europe, they were going to Britain. But now there's a duopoly over there. There's the motherland, ex-motherland, blah, 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 Britain, but it's Europe. How have you seen this change in your career? And your lead at RMIT.
You're absolutely right in what you say. And you mentioned Brexit before. Brexit itself did a wonderful amount of work to promote the European Union in Australia.
Anything to make the Brits look ridiculous? we're jointing at a hip. You know?
That's certainly an element of what happened. And to be blunt, I think there's no question that Brexit has made the UK look ridiculous. And it's something you can actually say with regret, that the impact of Brexit on the UK has been very damaging. Whereas for the European Union, in some ways, it's actually been a benefit not to have the UK there. That's not something they would ever say themselves. They would prefer the UK was in. But it has made decision making around a number of issues easier without the UK at the table.
Do I hear you talking about a European army, for example?
For example, a position of President Macron on European security is very clear, and he is certainly promoting an important debate in that direction. Beyond that, I suspect that it's still football that generates more interest in Europe than many other things. But there's no question that as the trade deal negotiations have developed, more and more businesses have become alert to the possibilities that exist in Europe. And certainly, as you say, that recognition that the European Union is something quite different from the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real pleasure to have you in a podcast. The gates and the doors or whatever, les portes sont toujours ouvertes. You're always welcome here. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you. Thank you very much.